Hello everyone, this is Vlad Glavanu. I am the Head of Psychology and Counseling at Webster University Geneva and Director of the Webster Center for Creativity and Innovation. And it is my great pleasure to be here today with Michael Hanchett-Hansen, who is Psychologist and Director of the Master's Concentration in Creativity and Cognition at Teachers College, Columbia University. Hi, Michael.
Hey, Vlad. Good to be here.
Excellent. Michael had gave us a great talk on curiosity and creativity. And today I want to unpack a little bit with his help one of his central ideas, which to me was the importance of questions in education primarily, but also outside of education. And my first question about questions, Michael, would be, why should we be more concerned with them and why now? Why questions? Why did you choose this topic?
The field of education today is sort of struggling with this existential angst about the rate of change, the changes in technologies, the changes in access to information, the extraordinary leaps in knowledge that are being made, and how, if you are, I teach teachers, of course,
right.
If you're a seventh grade teacher and you're teaching science and you have this sense, you have this uneasy sense that what you're teaching is not going to be applicable when these seventh graders are in college.
Right.
But you know what is applicable is the underlying, let's say that you're teaching biology, are many of the underlying big questions about biology.
Mm.
How does evolution occur?
Right.
What is adaptation? How do complex systems of like a forest system, let's say, impact the what are the loop feedback loops that occur between specific species and their environment? Those sorts of questions really do endure, and so we have then always, and we always, this has always been true, but the rate of change makes it so much more salient. We have these contingent, temporary, transient answers based on a history of how we have addressed this question before. And so that gives the student, the seventh grader, a marker for how to keep thinking about this question.
Right.
So that's one thing. The other thing is that I do, I worked with Howard Gruber, he was my mentor, and he did cases of people who do extraordinary creativity, or at least well-recognized creativity. And as I have continued his work and taught courses on case study method, I looked at hundreds of really extraordinary in-depth cases that my students have written, become more and more aware that many people who are successful in life and do really, really mind-blowing work have big questions at the core that are driving them. It's not so much, and this is where in yesterday's presentation I sort of began with this quote from Gruber, that It's they organize work not so much to feel satisfaction at each step, but to feel a liberation to think the next thought.
Right.
And that is something that's driven, I find, a lot by questions.
Right.
The third thing I will bring up is my own experience as an educator. And over the years, and as I've learned and thought about the field of creativity studies, I have found that it really helps students to give them all of the different contingent answers we have about ideation and personality traits, about environmental factors, and about the sort of distributed thought processes that you and I work in, and help them always link it back to what the questions are. What are the underlying questions that are driving all these theories? And that can put things in context for them and keep them from just throwing up their hands and saying, well, we don't know what creativity is.
Right.
Does that make any sense?
Absolutely. I was fascinated by the quote from Gruber, I think, and your own observations of how questions can liberate us. And I was thinking, I love playing devil's advocate, and I know you do too,
good.
I was thinking, you know, in education, people do use question. I mean, questioning.
Absolutely.
Students, yeah, that happens all the time, but not all questions are quite liberating. So if we think a little bit about types of questions and what makes a good question in the sense of a productive question, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, first of all, I want to reinforce what you just said, because a lot of the work that I have done in my own research has been around art education. I've worked a lot with museums, and inquiry-based models are very often what is used there. So they are question central, but I think we can push it even a little farther. Then this is where I've had this nagging feeling as I've done this sort of research. that the question can actually be, the understanding, the depth and understanding of the question can be central to the education, not simply a means of getting to another answer or right. of organizing how we're going to think about different perspectives on the question, but actually enriching and going deep, more deeply in the question. So to get to your question, when you're, and this I'll just say from my own teaching experience, it needs to be organic.
Right.
Very often when a master's or doctoral student comes to me and they're just beginning their work, they really don't have everything quite in mind, and they have this articulation of a question that quite frankly makes either no sense or is too abstract to be useful or something. But telling them that's not right,
right.
is not the developmental path to take, I have found. I've tried it, unfortunately. My apologies to those particular students. I found over time, I've done this for 20 years now, I found that it's not really the way to do it. You have to let them keep digging at that question
right.
and expanding and elaborating and rethinking it until really they have not one question, but a cluster of questions that are designed around a specific topic that help them construct what Gruber called a network of enterprise. Which is that in when we become professionals and we're adults and we're doing our work, we will have lots of projects going on or lots right. of things we're thinking about at the same time, or maybe only two or three, but there will be more than one, so that when we get stuck, we can go to another project, another point of view, another book that we're writing, another whatever.
Right. Right. And
that allows you to keep thinking about the same things, but in different ways and different right. contexts, et cetera. And again, giving you a deeper understanding of the questions. So we get to a classroom, and a student brings up a question. I know that this is something that you and I have discussed previously. Student brings up a question that really is not the question that you as the professor want here.
Yes.
It's not going the direction we need to go. It's not, you know, it's really not, you're not seeing the value of this. If the students in the group, and this requires some, you know, attention to the group as a whole, if the students in the group are seeming to, first thing I ask is who else has had similar concerns? And if we're getting some similar concerns, I find out how they articulate that question. So I don't discount it until we've explored it some. And then if we explore it some and I think it's really taking us a bad direction, I do say, okay, well, let's bracket that and maybe get back to it at a different time, because really right. I want us right now to go in a different direction.
Right.
I don't tell them it's a, you know, I don't in any way imply that that's a question that can't be fruitful, because generally, if you think about our whole history of creativity, every answer we come up with is that's really a big answer is generally thought of as crazy by somebody.
Right.
And right. often the person who does it, who thinks of it first, is the first person to think it's crazy.
Right.
And so it's organicness, and they're willing to explore.
So here, in a way, we're going a bit beyond the idea of the question and the anatomy of a question. Like a lot of, I'm sure research has been done on, you know, asking how and why, and they're deeper level questions, perhaps more surface level. But we're going towards this act of questioning and the curiosity part that you talked about, because you really, you know, what you're getting at here is a phenomenon. It's not just a question in and of itself, but the act of being curious. How do you relate to this notion of curiosity, and how do you relate it to creativity? You obviously gave quite some thought to that.
I have, and I will say that I began, you know, as I said, I've done this for many years, and I began by just making the assumption, for the usual way that we think about it, that curiosity is something that helps us get to creative products. And that's sort of the implied normative discourse within creativity studies. Curiosity studies are a little different. They don't necessarily relate to creativity,
right?
As it's usually framed. So I started there. And as I talked about in yesterday's talk, one of the key things was this really kind of extensive professional development that I did with a museum in New York City. And we worked with a set of teachers over a whole semester with 4 half days. And they did action research within their own classrooms about the relationship between curiosity, science, and art.
Right.
And it made me question a little bit this instrumental approach. That, and as I said, my own teaching, that really we need to think of, yes, questions lead us to answers, but those answers will always lead us back to the question.
Right.
And so it really is at the end of the day, and this is where I think that we give our students more, if I have a seventh grade student coming out of biology, that I have helped her or him come to the point of having some questions they see as their own. Mm. Now that, and this is just a style thing as much as anything, and maybe an instinct, if I talk to you about what are your questions, it seems sort of fleeting and superficial.
Right.
But if I ask you what's your curiosity, that has implications, I believe, at least in English, of having something deeper, having something more that you identify with.
Right.
And this gets sort of to the Desi and Ryan work, you know, on motivation, where the integration of the motivation into the identity is crucial to how the motivation works.
Right.
And if you have a curiosity that is centered and structured around these questions, it's different than just saying, what are your questions?
Right, right. Because people, I mean, as you said about particular questions, they can narrow things, they can take you in different directions, but the curiosity is where you want to tap into and understand, you know, the deeper level of engagement, you know, and the notion of concern that you mentioned. I was just thinking that a lot of, from the little I know about the curiosity literature, people talk about intellectual curiosity, and that's a great part of what you're also kind of explaining, and kind of getting at the epistemological, the logic behind the question and the view of the world that the question brings. And then there is the emotional part of the question, because we talked a little bit about wonder, which is this other side to curiosity in a way, considered initially an emotion, a type of emotion, and the relation they have with surprise, for instance, and other very basic deep emotions. What do you make of the relation between curiosity and affect? Did you mentioned motivation right now, but the way people experience these moments of curiosity, should we focus on that emotional aspect of it as well? What role does it play?
From my reading of the literature, this is actually one of the advantages to linking curiosity and creativity. Mm. One of, you know, Gruber himself, whom I studied with, saw the individual as an evolving system with subsystems of knowledge, purpose, and affect, where purpose was sort of this emergent first among equals that worked within the system. But he quite frankly didn't have a whole lot to say about affect. It was really, it's really highly under-theorized within his own theory.
Right.
And he's not unusual. I find that affect is discussed, and in some theories, but not usually cognitive-related theories, it is discussed in more detail. If you go way back to existential work of Rollo May, or you go to certainly the psychoanalytic literature, emotions become very important. But we've sort of got this break. In the curiosity literature, affect is a little more prominent, I find, across the board.
Right.
And I think that's one of the advantages to it for us, that it brings affect in, because I don't think that you have an idea that doesn't accompany an emotion. They don't fall apart like that.
Right. And you did mention something interesting yesterday. I mean, the history of thinking about curiosity and wonder and related phenomena takes you back to a more recent yet old history of the sublime and the idea of terror and fear, because often you want to think that these are very energizing, and they are kind of emotionally arousing kind of phenomena, but not only positive, they can also be negative. You can experience some kind of a negative affect. Is there any role you see to this fear and even the feeling of terror and the notion of curiosity? That's an interesting, you know, historical question.
Yeah, and I think I think there's a lot of unpacking to do there, because let's just start with the idea of the sublime.
Right.
And I did, and in my presentation yesterday, I quoted Burke on a separate factor, but the sublime is certainly very salient here. So the sublime has this sense of terror in it, right? But it becomes striking, and, you know, to talk about it in really cognitive terms, encoded more because of the terror, because we do encode things that are fearful more than things that are joyful in general.
Right.
And so it becomes this very strong encoding for the sublime. So, you know, that's a positive side, but there are no constructs in any context is totally positive.
Mm.
This is what the complex systems work that you and I do, and looking at distributed creativity, it tells us that the loops, all of the feedback loops, will include unanticipated consequences, and so nothing's going to be good all the time.
Right.
And as, you know, in yesterday's, I tried to make lots of cat references, because I know you love cats.
Obviously.
And Curiosity Killed the Cat, and that has a very deep background. That first of all, it is in current research, it just looks at risk-taking, which can be quote-unquote appropriate or inappropriate, and that's always a subjective judgment, often, depending right. on outcome. And but it has a deeper one. It has, in Christian theology and mythology, it goes back to Eve. In ancient mythology, it went back to Pandora. Right. You know, there that this, and when you went back, even within creativity literature, if we go back to the early 20th century, if we go back to early 19th century rather, and how Mary Shelley began it with Frankenstein, that was a lesson, right? An object right. lesson in curiosity.
Exactly.
And the dangers of curiosity. And at that time, it was seen as a pretty dangerous thing. Right. Today, we are very much affected by the sort of a zeitgeist rhetoric about creativity always being good and curiosity being part of of creativity, and so it's very hard for people to think about it being bad. But obviously it can be bad.
Right. I mean, these examples tell you of where curiosity can lead you, but then there is another even deeper level of questioning going around the idea of being curious as a state of mind. So curiosity killed the cat, but it also killed Socrates in some ways, because he was condemned by the Athenians at the time because he corrupted the mind of the youth by making them rather unengaged with their social environment. It's a weird kind of paradox there. Curiosity does relate us to the world, but sometimes it relates us to a more abstract level of the world, and it takes us away from the immediate. And here there are the stories of Thales, who fell into a pit while he was contemplating the night sky, you know, if you relate back to wonder. So does curiosity connect us or disconnect us from the world? And how does it relate to action? If you're always curious, if you're always asking questions, will you ever act on anything? What are your thoughts on that, on those limitations?
The way I would like to encourage us to think about this is that it is almost the opposite. To sit around, to be Thales, sitting around pondering the night sky all the time and not acting is almost the opposite of what I'm trying to do in education. Because right. I think we almost need to think, if we're going to explore a question, we have to continually feed that question with new information, new context, new investigations, new actions. If an artist, for instance, is working with let's say that you're a painter and you're working with the concept of what is a boundary. Takashi Okada has a wonderful case that they've written up around this kind of a situation. There's a lot of actually walking around and looking at boundaries. There's a lot of painting right. different boundaries. There's a lot of going back to art and art history and looking. There's a lot of information you feed to elaborate the question into sub-questions and related questions and juxtapositions and the questioning of juxtapositions. So if you're not constantly learning the old, which I would call education, right? Learning the old right. answers and and bringing them into your question, and then exploring new answers, what we would call creativity, and bringing them into the question, then I think that you're not fully using the question, and you're really using the question as a way of avoiding something else.
Right.
So to be educative, that means that there is this process. That said, you know, it's not... Life unfolds in time, as you and I have both written about. Temporal right. distribution of thought is a big issue.
Right.
It's not always going to be the same. There are nights when you're going to sit around on the couch and just let your mind wander.
Right.
But that is going to work, and that's going to be helpful to you only if it's embedded in a longer-term intensive work.
Yeah, and a project, going back to the project
idea. Or 10 projects, whatever.
Right? Yeah, yeah, and the network.
Right, the enterprise.
I mean, luckily for us, we do have a network of concepts here that help us unpack a little bit these passive and active dimensions of a phenomenon like wonder. I mean, for me personally, curiosity is one of these active, searching, exploratory phenomena. Wonder, to my mind, is a bit more balancing these aspects. And then you have awe, which is kind of outgrowing from the sublime literature, that is putting you in the face of something greater than yourself. And it kind of temporarily, you know, makes you kind of, yeah, stop for a moment, you know, to take all of that in. So that's a different state of mind. I was thinking here about the relation between stupor and the way we call today stupidity and the bêtise in French. You know, there is another kind of historical line there of the way in which this complexity can make you dumb at a point in which you don't know how to respond. So as you beautifully said it, if you look at it in a temporal line, all of these phenomena, however we call them, you know, they kind of flow one into another, and it depends on what they're embedded in at a kind of greater point.
So let me turn the thing that around to you, and I'm really interested in this. You talked about wonder as a state of mind. So a state of mind is usually something that comes and goes.
Right.
Is that how you see wonder as something that comes and goes for someone?
So I, you know, going back to this division between state of mind, internal, personal, and the world, I prefer to talk of wonder as experience and the experience of wondering. So in a kind of a Dewean sense, put it in between person and environment, because both curiosity and wonder have an inner kind of trigger at times, but also have an external kind of motor and trigger, and it's the encounter that kind of keeps them going somehow. So when I say state of mind, I do acknowledge that wonder is many things. As a state of mind, it seems to me like a more generalized experience that is it's kind of an experience that you go back to again and again, and it comes to be part of who you are, you know, as a person. And I do think that some people are perhaps more inclined to be curious and wonder, maybe about specific things, and other people perhaps not. You know, this contemplative life, you know, as they used to be called, maybe it's not as equally distributed. So yeah, the state of mind part, I would rather call it an experience. How do you look at creativity? You mentioned yesterday it can be a trait, a skill, a state of mind itself. You know, what is your preferred way of looking at it?
Actually, can I
you can
bracket
go further.
That one for just a minute?
Do it.
Because what you were saying really did trigger some thoughts in me. Let's just collect them for a second here.
Right.
It seems to me, from what you building on what you just said, agreeing with everything you just said, but building on it just a little bit, that the state of wonder in relation to curiosity gives you an assumption of an inexhaustibility of certain questions.
Exactly. Right.
Whereas we're always, and there is an instrumentality to any question. There's an instrumentality dimension and what we might call, I hadn't thought of it this way, but a wonder dimension, right?
Right.
That you will not exhaust this question. And one of the, you know, the underlying big questions that I noted yesterday was one that my colleague Patricia Stokes brought up for Frank Lloyd Wright, where she said he organized all of his work around the central question of what is organic architecture. Well, that's an inexhaustible question.
Right.
But one that can be responded to and whose dimensions can be explored again and again and again.
Right.
Gruber, whom I studied with early in his career, encountered a set of literature that made him wonder about how long it takes to think.
Yeah.
Again, an inexhaustible question with all kinds of different answers that can be applied to it. And it seems to me that the wonder could almost be seen as a dimension of curiosity here that brings in the inexhaustibleness. I would almost go back to the Christian tradition of the religious mystery.
Right.
The mystery is something that is not answerable, but on which you continually meditate.
Yeah.
You continually go back to it,
right?
But you never are expected to answer it.
Right.
It doesn't have a theological dogma, or it may have a dogma, but it's not the dogma you're trying to understand. It's the mystery. Right. And to me, that is sort of the wonder aspect of curiosity. Does that make sense to you at all?
Well, it does. I mean, I'm kind of always a bit skeptical about dimensions, because I personally, I never typologize phenomena. I try
it's
not to.
You didn't
know,
study architecture, isn't it?
Exactly. If I had. If only I had. But what I like to think is what is the thing behind both creativity, creativity indeed, but curiosity and wonder, is the idea of knowledge, right? I mean, all of these kind of came from how do we know the world? How do you know ourselves, right? Know yourself, and the old idea of philosophy is born out of wonder, right? Going back to Socrates. But the knowledge part has a known and a not known, and then has a familiar and an unfamiliar. And it is these two processes, if I am to think of curiosity and wonder, it's again me, you know, and there are some other thinkers who I would align to this, but it's just one option, one way of looking at it. curiosity is a process of familiarizing the world. Like you're intrigued, you're kind of tickled by something that you want to explain, and then in a Piagetian sense, perhaps you apply old schemas to the new, or you kind of create a new schema, but it kind of domesticates a bit the world for you, and maybe that's how you satiate your curiosity. So that's one aspect. Wonder is when you dwell in the unknown. That's what Heidegger would say. So you exactly mm-hmm. say remain with that idea that even if you come up with ABCD answers, the question will remain. I mean, that's exactly what Socrates said. What I know is that I know nothing. I mean, right, that was the thing that kind of scared the government at the time, you know, thinking about what does that state of mind, you know, do to people. So to my mind, you can't really sustain wonder, perhaps, for a very, very long period of time, because it really opens you up to this indeterminate possibility in front of you of everything. You know, the familiar suddenly becomes strange. In curiosity, often we go a bit the other way around. But having said that, I'm not into, I don't think of them in terms of dimensions. I look at them maybe as a font and figure, kind of background and figure, kind of a figure in some ways. And I try to look at how they collaborate. But if we go back, I would love to talk about knowing and not knowing and the value of not knowing as a kind of a driving force behind both, if it makes sense. Yeah,
yeah. I like the figure ground right. analogy for it. I think I would still stick with dimensions, but, you know, that's me.
Well, architecture
but,
would do that.
But I like the figure ground idea that, you know, especially in the famous Gestalt experiments where mm-hmm. the two will go back and forth.
Right.
And I think that, you know, like you said, as we both said there, that wonder is sort of establishes the inexhaustibility of the question.
Right. And it is so transformative. So, of course, you talk about how curiosity can transform you, and it definitely can. And you can't wonder without also being curious at some point and explore. So they do need each other. Wonder has
this. Just spend a moment and go back to Socrates.
Let's do it. Yes.
Yes. Because, I mean, you know, I always... You know, I being the curmudgeon of our group, always am the one who wants to say, well, wait, what's the problem here? What's the downside? Right. And I think that you brought up a very interesting one that we might be able to just put in some historical context here, that, you know, Socrates was opening up, or at least was one of the people who became famous for opening up, or infamous in his own time, this idea of the inexhaustibility of the question
mm-hmm.
and the fact that you did have to tie things back to questions. It was a shot across the bow, and it was a establishing of a new territory, or to mix metaphors. Mm. But if we go further than Socrates, and we say, okay, we make the question inexhaustible, and we make the question central,
yes,
and we understand in terms of the 21st century that indeed the contingency and temporality of our answers are one of the end of our technologies, are, you know, central to our experience of life,
mm-hmm.
then maybe we're to slightly point Socrates 2.0 or 3.0
right.
in terms of the same thing, that the questions are central to the world and how we can understand it, and how we can understand it in a useful way and a stance toward the future.
Mm.
But it doesn't require it. It does not make the youth sit around and just scratch their heads all the time, and right. not because it. It right. actually requires the action in the world.
Right. No, I absolutely. I mean, this idea of passive active, and Socrates' point 2.0 could even be Aristotle, because Aristotle did
That's true, exactly.
bring up right the wonder. Just that for him, it was the idea of getting to know. So wonder was very useful because it led you to knowing, right? So that satiating wonder, satiating one's curiosity, was the end goal, and he really kind of prized and you know that end goal. While Socrates looked at the process and said that the moment you have this end goal and you stop wondering basically at that point, right? And then you have this history continuing with Descartes, who looked at admiration, right, l'admiration, which is kind of similar to wonder, and he looked at it as the most basic emotion you can have in relation to the new, and he looked at it as a passion. So for him, passions were again lower than reason, because sometimes they kind of blur your reason. So in terms of wonder and activity and action, vision, you have almost two things. One is that people tend to keep them separate, which, as you said, and I completely agree, you can sit around and wonder, but you're not going to do that forever. And it's part of an organic way of living your life with acting and meditating, contemplating things and so on. But then there is the other part of taking you on wrong paths that you should not be traveling, being driven by emotion more than by reason. So that's another kind of underlining accusation somehow. And it was Heidegger indeed who more recently-ish kind of brought wonder back with the dwelling in the unknown. And then he himself was accused of too much wondering in an era when the Nazis around him were doing what they were doing, and he kind of, you know, went along with that, just contemplating these big questions. And Hannah Arendt, finally, you know, to come to your point,
right,
she said that you cannot have citizenship without wonder. So she kind of recovered that idea. She looked at the criticism of wonder as passive, and she kind of brought it back to this idea of engagement. Yes. So it's such a
Arendt
beautiful
is wonderful
history
on
of,
that, and I think it's a great right, place, yeah, right, for that too. To leave.
Michael, this has been amazing. I want to take us back to a concrete question, a final question, because some people who are listening to us, maybe some of them are educators. Everyone is an educator to others and to themselves. So if you're a teacher, we talked about so many things, right? What can you do to start off this process of transforming education by putting the question at the center? What are, of course, there's no recipe, but what would be the first ways or kind of advice you would give to teachers who enter the classroom and they think, you know, I need to do something of this type of knowledge?
Well, one of the key things that we do as teachers is that we model the way we think. And I think that, you know, in a time, again, when education is grappling with all kinds of new technologies and distance learning and computer-based learning is trying to be integrated, we find again and again, whether you're working in a big organization or a corporation or a school system, that the actual presence of the teacher is really important.
Right.
One aspect of that importance of the teacher is just to model what is it to be someone who has dedicated a large part of their life to the study of the psychology of creativity. Mm. What does that look like?
Right.
And the only way you figure that out is by experiencing it. So I would start with I think with all teachers, you start with, what are you teaching and what are your questions?
Mm.
How do you approach this? And you know, sketch it out many times.
Right.
You know, use scrap paper so you can throw them away and you can redo it. And think about your questions. And then as the students raise questions, become aware of how you're dealing with them. One of the things in that professional development that I was talking about yesterday that we had done around curiosity, art, and science is a very common practice in terms of dealing with curiosity and questions, etc., is to have a wall or a bulletin board where you post questions that you don't have time for, or you don't have information for, or whatever, to get back to.
Yeah.
And as the semester went on and I like listened to the teacher's talk, there was a little bit of a sense of that there was this growing monster in their room of this wall of questions, right?
Right.
And I think that when you can, to the extent that you can start thinking about the understanding of the questions and the implications of the questions as part of your outcome.
Yeah.
Now, you're going to have a problem with this, right? It's not going to be on the tests.
No.
Your standardized tests are not going to go there.
Right.
Your curriculum standards may have inquiry, and they may have complexity, which this can feed into. They may have lots of things that this feeds into, but it's probably not going to state it exactly this way.
Yeah.
So there is an integration challenge, but that is what education is. We are, experienced teachers, we are always integrating the methods to the outcomes. And so helping the students understand the underlying questions of their domain, how they've evolved over time, what are the outstanding questions? That would get back to Kuhn's paradigm shift, right? What are the anomalies we're not able with our current paradigms to talk about? Helping them just start down that path and see where it leads you. At least from my experience, from the 20 years that I've taught graduate school, I found it really, really useful. And more I am able to take a question that a student brings in and talk about the contingent answers and take them back to the question.
Right.
How does this answer affect how we think about the question? And so just start the process. There are no magic bullets.
Exactly.
Teaching is part science, part art.
Right. A lot of craft.
Right. And so is living. This is not a magic bullet for living either.
Right.
Like, as we said, there are always unexpected outcomes and there are always negative possibilities. And, you know, they may make you drink hemlock at the end of the day. That may happen.
Yeah.
But it is, I think it is an important thing for us to think about in education, especially in the conditions that we're working in today.
Right. I mean, you brought up beautifully these institutional constraints and curriculum, but also the work on yourself that you have to do, opening yourself up, becoming vulnerable in some ways, right, to this unknown and ambivalence, and just living with them for a little while, which is something uncomfortable for most of us, but something that I think we both can argue we can learn a lot from.
Yeah, and can I build on that for just a minute? Because there's, in this kind of training, right, there are two kinds of vulnerabilities here.
Mm.
One is the vulnerability of admitting that you don't know. The student brings up, you've said we're going to use curiosity as part of our education here, and the student brings up a question completely out of left field. You have no idea, and you haven't thought about it. And that is a vulnerability that can be really frightening and negative on a lot of levels. Not only if it happens often enough do you start losing credibility as a teacher, but the students get frustrated. It's not use. They don't see any reason to bring up questions anymore if you're constantly telling them to, well, go look, go research that for yourself. They're like doing this, producing homework for themselves. That's going to be frustrating. There's a different kind of vulnerability to starting with your own questions and thinking about how those questions have opened up how you think about the domain. And that, when the unexpected question comes up, is going to give you a better ground, I think, to stand on, a little more, things are not as much out of left field, even if the question isn't one of yours.
Right.
I think you will, I mean, at least it's been my experience. And again, it's an art, there are no magic bullets.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Michael, for all these thoughts. It has been delightful to talk to Michael Hansen, who is director of the Master's Concentration in Creativity and Cognition at Teachers College, Columbia University. If you want to know more about Michael's talk that we've been mentioning many times, it has actually been recorded, and you can find it on the Facebook page of the Webster Center for Creativity and Innovation. And if you want to know more about creativity, curiosity, questions, imagination, and other topics, do listen to our podcast. You can find them at podcast.webster.ch. Thank you again, Michael, for everything.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks.